be fewer stable elements out of which to create life. If epsilon were 0.008, then fusion would have been so rapid that no hydrogen would have survived from the Big Bang, and there would be no stars today to give energy to the planets. Or perhaps two protons would have bound together, also making fusion in the stars impossible. Rees points to the fact that Fred Hoyle found that even a shift as small as 4% in the nuclear force would have made the formation of carbon impossible in the stars, making the higher elements, and hence life, impossible. Hoyle found that if one changed the nuclear force slightly, then beryllium would be so unstable that it could never be a bridge to form carbon atoms. Second is N, equal to 10 to the 36th power, which is the strength of the electric force divided by the strength of gravity, which shows how weak gravity is. If gravity were even weaker, then stars could not condense and create the enormous temperatures necessary for fusion. Hence, stars would not shine, and the planets would plunge into freezing darkness. But if gravity were a bit stronger, this would cause stars to heat up too fast, and they would burn up their fuel so quickly that life could never get started. Also, a stronger gravity would mean that galaxies would form earlier and would be quite small. The stars would be more densely packed, making disastrous collisions between various stars and planets. Third is omega, the relative density of the universe. If omega were too small, then the universe would have expanded and cooled too fast. But if omega were too large, then the universe would have collapsed before life could start. Rees writes, "At 1 second after the Big Bang, omega cannot have differed from unity by more than one part in a million billion, 1 in 10 to the 15th power, in order that the universe should now, after 10 billion years, be still expanding and with a value of omega that has certainly not departed wildly from unity." Fourth is lambda, the cosmological constant which determines the acceleration of the universe. If it were just a few times larger, the anti-gravity it would create would blow the universe apart, sending it into an immediate big freeze, making life impossible. But if the cosmological constant were negative, the universe would have contracted violently into a big crunch, too soon for life to form. In other words, the cosmological constant, like omega, must also be within a certain narrow band to make life possible. Fifth is Q, the amplitude of the irregularities in the cosmic microwave background, which equals 10 to the negative 5th power. If this number were a bit smaller, then the universe would be extremely uniform, a lifeless mass of gas and dust, which would never condense into the stars and galaxies of today. The universe would be dark, uniform, featureless, and lifeless. If Q were larger, then matter would have condensed earlier in the history of the universe into huge supergalactic structures. These great gobs of matter would have condensed into huge black holes, says Rees. These black holes would be heavier than an entire cluster of galaxies. Whatever stars can form in these huge clusters of gas would be so tightly packed that planetary systems would be impossible. Last is D, the number of spatial dimensions. Due to interest in M theory, physicists have returned to the question of whether life is possible in higher or lower dimensions. If space is one-dimensional, then life probably cannot exist because the universe is trivial. Usually, when physicists try to apply the quantum theory to one-dimensional universes, we find that particles pass through one another without interacting. So it's possible that universes existing in one dimension cannot support life because particles cannot stick together to form increasingly complex objects. In two space dimensions, we also have a problem, because life forms would probably disintegrate. Imagine a two-dimensional race of flat beings, called Flatlanders, living on a tabletop. Imagine them trying to eat. The passage extending from its mouth to its rear would split the Flatlander in half, and he would fall apart. Thus, it's difficult to imagine how a Flatlander could exist as a complex being without disintegrating or falling into separate pieces. Another argument from biology indicates that intelligence cannot exist in fewer than three dimensions. Our brain consists of a large number of overlapping neurons connected by a vast electrical network. If the universe were one- or two-dimensional, then it would be difficult to construct complex neural networks, especially if they short-circuited by being placed on top of each other. In lower dimensions, we are severely limited by the number of complex logic circuits and neurons we can place in a small area. Our own brain, for example, consists of about 100 billion neurons, about as many stars as in the Milky Way galaxy, with each neuron connected to about 10,000 other neurons. Such complexity would be hard to duplicate in lower dimensions. In four-space dimensions, one has another problem. Planets are not stable in their orbits around the sun. Newton's inverse square law is replaced by an inverse cube law. And in 1917, Paul Ehrenfest, a close colleague of Einstein, speculated about what physics might look like in other dimensions. He analyzed what is called the Poisson-Laplace equation, which governs the motion of planetary objects as well as electric charges in atoms, and found that orbits are not stable in four or higher spatial dimensions. Since electrons in atoms, as well as planets, experience random collisions, this means that atoms and solar systems probably cannot exist in higher dimensions. In other words, three dimensions are special. To Riis, the anthropic principle is one of the most compelling arguments for the multiverse. In the same way that the existence of Goldilocks zones for Earth implies extrasolar planets, the existence of Goldilocks zones for the universe implies there are parallel universes. Riis comments, "If there is a large stock of clothing, you're not surprised to find a suit that fits. If there are many universes, each governed by a differing set of numbers, there will be one where there is a particular set of numbers suitable to life. We are in that one." In other words, our universe is the way it is because of the law of averages over many universes in the multiverse, not because of a grand design. Weinberg seems to agree on this point. Weinberg, in fact, finds the idea of a multiverse intellectually pleasing. He never did like the idea that time could suddenly spring into existence at the Big Bang, and that time could not exist before that. In a multiverse, we have the eternal creation of universes. There is another quirky reason why Riis prefers the multiverse idea. The universe, he finds, contains a small amount of ugliness. For example, Earth's orbit is slightly elliptical. If it were perfectly spherical, then one might argue, as theologians have, that it was a byproduct of divine intervention. But it is not, indicating a certain amount of randomness within the narrow Goldilocks band. Similarly, the cosmological constant is not perfectly zero, but is small, which indicates that our universe is no more special than our presence requires. This is all consistent with our universe being randomly generated by accident. Evolution of Universes. Being an astronomer rather than a philosopher, Riis says that the bottom line is that all these theories have to be testable. In fact, that is the reason why he favors the multiverse idea rather than competing mystical theories. The multiverse theory, he believes, can be tested in the next 20 years. One variation of the multiverse idea is actually testable today. Physicist Lee Smolin goes even further than Riis and assumes that an evolution of universes took place, analogous to Darwinian evolution, ultimately leading to universes like ours. In the chaotic inflationary theory, for example, The physical constants of the daughter universes have slightly different physical constants than the mother universe. If universes can sprout from black holes, as some physicists believe, then the universes that dominate the multiverse are those that have the most black holes. This means that, as in the animal kingdom, the universes that give rise to the most children eventually dominate to spread their genetic information, the physical constants of nature. If true, then our universe might have had an infinite number of ancestor universes in the past, and our universe is a byproduct of trillions of years of natural selection. In other words, our universe is the byproduct of survival of the fittest, meaning it is the child of universes with the maximum number of black holes. Although a Darwinian evolution among universes is a strange and novel idea, Smalin believes that it can be tested by simply counting the number of black holes. Our universe should be maximally favorable to the creation of black holes. However, one still has to prove that the universes with the most black holes are the ones that favor life, like ours. Because this idea is testable, counterexamples can be considered. For example, perhaps it can be shown, by hypothetically adjusting the physical parameters of the universe, that black holes are most readily produced in universes that are lifeless. For example, perhaps one might be able to show that a universe with a much stronger nuclear force has stars that burn out extremely quickly, creating large numbers of supernovae that then collapse into black holes. In such a universe, a larger value for the nuclear force means that stars live for brief periods, and hence life cannot get started. But this universe might also have more black holes, thereby disproving Smalin's idea. The advantage of this idea is that it can be tested, reproduced, or falsified, the hallmark of any true scientific theory. Time will tell whether it holds up or not. Although any theory involving wormholes, superstrings, and higher dimensions is beyond our current experimental ability, new experiments are now being conducted and future ones planned that may determine whether these theories are correct or not. We are in the midst of a revolution in experimental science, with the full power of satellites, space telescopes, gravity wave detectors, and lasers being brought to bear on these questions. The bountiful harvest from these experiments could very well resolve some of the deepest questions in cosmology. Chapter 9. Searching for Echoes from the 11th Dimension. Remarkable claims require remarkable proof. Carl Sagan. Parallel universes, dimensional portals, and higher dimensions, as spectacular as they are, require airtight proof of their existence. As the astronomer Ken Crosswell remarks, "Other universes can get intoxicating. You can say anything you want about them and never be proven wrong, as long as astronomers never see them." Previously, it seemed hopeless to test many of these predictions, given the primitiveness of our experimental equipment. However, recent advances in computers, lasers, and satellite technology have put many of these theories tantalizingly close to experimental verification. Direct verification of these ideas may prove to be exceedingly difficult, but indirect verification may be within reach. We sometimes forget that much of astronomical science is done indirectly. For example, no one has ever visited the sun or the stars, yet we know what the stars are made of by analyzing the light given off by these luminous objects. By analyzing the spectrum of light within starlight, we know indirectly that the stars are made primarily of hydrogen and some helium. Likewise, no one has ever seen a black hole, and, in fact, black holes are invisible and cannot be directly seen. However, we see indirect evidence of their existence by looking for accretion disks and computing the mass of these dead stars. In all these experiments, we look for echoes from the stars and black holes to determine their nature. Likewise, the 11th dimension may be beyond our direct reach, but there are ways in which inflation and superstring theory may be verified in light of the new revolutionary instruments now at our disposal. GPS and relativity. The simplest example of the way satellites have revolutionized research in relativity is the Global Positioning System, GPS, in which 24 satellites continually orbit Earth, emitting precise, synchronized pulses which allow one to triangulate one's position on the planet to remarkable accuracy. The GPS has become an essential feature of navigation, commerce, as well as warfare. Everything from computerized maps inside cars to cruise missiles depends on the ability to synchronize signals to within 50 billionths of a second to locate an object on Earth to within 15 yards. But in order to guarantee such incredible accuracy, scientists must calculate slight corrections to Newton's laws due to relativity, which states that radio waves will be slightly shifted in frequency as satellites soar in outer space. In fact, if we foolishly discard the corrections due to relativity, then the GPS clocks will run faster each day by 40,000 billionths of a second, and the entire system will become unreliable. Relativity theory is thus absolutely essential for commerce and the military. Physicist Clifford Will, who once briefed a U.S. Air Force general about the crucial corrections to the GPS coming from Einstein's theory of relativity, once commented that he knew that relativity theory had come of age when even senior Pentagon officials had to be briefed on it. Gravity wave detectors. So far, almost everything we know about astronomy has come in the form of electromagnetic radiation, whether it's starlight or radio or microwave signals from deep space. Now scientists are introducing the first new medium for scientific discovery, gravity itself. "Every time we have looked at the sky in a new way, we have seen a new universe," says Gary Sanders of Caltech and deputy director of the Gravity Wave Project. It was Einstein in 1916 who first proposed the existence of gravity waves. Consider what would happen if the sun disappeared. Recall the analogy of a bowling ball sinking into a mattress, or better, a trampoline net. If the ball is suddenly removed, the trampoline net will immediately spring back into its original position, creating shock waves that ripple outward along the trampoline net. If the bowling ball is replaced by the sun, then we see that shock waves of gravity travel at a specific speed, the speed of light. Although Einstein later found an exact solution of his equations that allowed for gravity waves, he despaired of ever seeing his prediction verified in his lifetime. Gravity waves are extremely weak. Even the shock waves of colliding stars are not strong enough to be measured by current experiments. At present, gravity waves have only been detected indirectly. Two physicists, Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor Jr., conjectured that if you analyze circling binary neutron stars that chase each other in space, then each star would emit a stream of gravity waves similar to the wake created by stirring molasses as their orbit slowly decays. They analyzed the death spiral of two neutron stars as they slowly spiraled toward each other. The focus of their investigation was the double neutron star PSR 1913+16, located about 16,000 light-years from Earth, which orbit around each other every 7 hours, 45 minutes, in the process emitting gravity waves into outer space. Using Einstein's theory, they found that the two stars should come closer by a millimeter every revolution. Although this is a fantastically small distance, it increases to a yard over a year, as the orbit of 435,000 miles slowly decreases in size. Their pioneering work showed that the orbit decayed precisely as Einstein's theory predicted on the basis of gravity waves. Einstein's equations, in fact, predict that the stars will eventually plunge into each other within 240 million years, due to the loss of energy radiated into space in the form of gravity waves. For their work, they won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1993. We can also go backward and use this precision experiment to measure the accuracy of general relativity itself. When the calculations are done backward, we find that general relativity is at least 99.7% accurate. LIGO Gravity Wave Detector. But to extract usable information about the early universe, one must observe gravity waves directly, not indirectly. In 2003, the first operational gravity wave detector, LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, finally came online, realizing a decades-old dream of probing the mysteries of the universe with gravity waves. The goal of LIGO is to detect cosmic events that are too distant or tiny to be observed by Earth telescopes, such as colliding black holes or neutron stars. LIGO consists of two gigantic laser facilities, one in Hanford, Washington, and the other in Livingston Parish, Louisiana. Each facility has two pipes, each 2.5 miles long, creating a gigantic L-shaped tubing. Within each tube, a laser is fired. At the joint of the L, both laser beams collide, and their waves interfere with each other. Normally, if there are no disturbances, then the two waves are synchronized so that they cancel each other out. But even when the tiniest gravity wave emitted from colliding black holes or neutron stars hits the apparatus, it causes one arm to contract and expand differently than the other arm. This disturbance is sufficient to disrupt the delicate cancellation of the two laser beams. As a result, the two beams, instead of canceling each other out, create a characteristic wave-like interference pattern that can be computer-analyzed in detail. The larger the gravity wave, the greater the mismatch between the two laser beams, and the larger the interference pattern. LIGO is an engineering marvel. Since air molecules may absorb the laser light, the tube containing the light has to be evacuated down to a trillionth of atmospheric pressure. Each detector takes up 300,000 cubic feet of space, meaning that LIGO has the largest artificial vacuum in the world. What gives LIGO such sensitivity, in part, is the design of the mirrors, which are controlled by tiny magnets, six in all, each the size of an ant. The mirrors are so polished that they are accurate to one part in 30 billionths of an inch. Imagine the Earth were that smooth, then the average mountain wouldn't rise more than an inch, says Garolyn Billingsley, who monitors the mirrors. They are so delicate that they can be moved by less than a millionth of a meter, which makes the LIGO mirrors perhaps the most sensitive in the world. Most control systems engineers' jaws drop when they hear what we're trying to do, says LIGO scientist Michael Zucker. Because LIGO is so exquisitely balanced, it is sometimes plagued by slight, unwanted vibrations from the most unlikely sources. The detector in Louisiana, for example, cannot be run during the day because of loggers who are cutting trees 1,500 feet from the site. LIGO is so sensitive that even if the logging were to take place a mile away, it still could not be run during the daytime. Even at night, vibrations from passing freight trains at midnight and 6 a.m. bracket how much continuous time the LIGO can operate. Even something as faint as ocean waves striking the coastline miles away can affect the results. Ocean waves breaking on North American beaches wash ashore every 6 seconds on average, and this creates a low growl that can actually be picked up by the lasers. The noise is so low in frequency, in fact, that it actually penetrates right through the earth. It feels like a rumble, says Zucker, commenting about this tidal noise. It's a huge headache during the Louisiana hurricane season. LIGO is also affected by the tides created by the moon's and sun's gravity tugging on Earth, creating a disturbance of several millionths of an inch. In order to eliminate these incredibly tiny disturbances, LIGO engineers have gone to extraordinary lengths to isolate much of the apparatus. Each laser system rests on top of four huge stainless steel platforms, each stacked on top of each other. Each level is separated by springs to damp any vibration. Sensitive optical instruments each have their own seismic isolation system. The floor is a slab of 30-inch thick concrete that is not coupled to the walls. LIGO is actually part of an international consortium, including the French-Italian detector called Virgo in Pisa, Italy, a Japanese detector called TAMA outside Tokyo, and a British-German detector called GEO 600 in Hanover, Germany. Altogether, LIGO's final construction cost will be $292 million, plus $80 million for commissioning and upgrades, making it the most expensive project ever funded by the National Science Foundation. But even with this sensitivity, many scientists concede that LIGO may not be sensitive enough to detect truly interesting events in its lifetime. The next upgrade of the facility, LIGO 2, is scheduled to be completed in 2014. If LIGO does not detect gravity waves, the betting is that LIGO 2 will. LIGO scientist Kenneth Librecht claims that LIGO 2 will improve the sensitivity of the equipment 1,000-fold. You go from detecting one event every 10 years, which is pretty painful, to an event every 3 days, which is very nice. For LIGO to detect the collision of two black holes within a distance of 300 million light-years, a scientist could wait anywhere from a year to 1,000 years. Many astronomers may have second thoughts about investigating such an event with LIGO if it means that their great-great-great-grandchildren will be the ones to witness the event. But as LIGO scientist Peter Salson has said, "People take pleasure in solving these technical challenges, much the way medieval cathedral builders continued working, knowing they might not see the finished church. But if there wasn't a fighting chance to see a gravity wave during my life career, I wouldn't be in this field. It's not just Nobel fever. The levels of precision we are striving for mark our business. If you do this, you have the right stuff." With LIGO 2, the chances are much better of finding a truly interesting event in our lifetime. LIGO 2 might detect colliding black holes within a much larger distance of 6 billion light-years at a rate of 10 per day to 10 per year. Even LIGO 2, however, will not be powerful enough to detect gravity waves emitted from the instant of creation. For that, we must wait another 15 to 20 years for LISA. LISA Gravity Wave Detector. LISA, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, represents the next generation in gravity wave detectors. Unlike LIGO, it will be based in outer space. Around 2010, NASA and the European Space Agency plan to launch 3 satellites into space. They will orbit around the Sun at approximately 30 million miles from Earth. The 3 laser detectors will form an equilateral triangle in space, 5 million kilometers on a side. Each satellite will have 2 lasers that allow it to be in continual contact with the other 2 satellites. Although each laser will fire a beam with only 0.5 watt of power, the optics are so sensitive that they will be able to detect vibrations coming from gravity waves with an accuracy of 1 part in a billion trillion, corresponding to a shift that is 1/100th the width of a single atom. LISA should be able to detect gravity waves from a distance of 9 billion light-years, which cuts across most of the visible universe. LISA will be so accurate that it might detect the original shock waves from the Big Bang itself. This will give us by far the most accurate look at the instant of creation.
If all goes according to plan, Lisa should be able to peer to within the first trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, making it perhaps the most powerful of all cosmological tools. It is believed that Lisa may be able to find the first experimental data on the precise nature of the unified field theory, the theory of everything. Lisa, or its successors, may provide the smoking gun for the inflationary theory. So far, inflation is consistent with all cosmological data, flatness, fluctuations in the cosmic background, and so forth, but that doesn't mean the theory is correct. To clinch the theory, scientists want to examine the gravity waves that were set off by the inflationary process itself. The fingerprint of gravity waves created at the instant of the Big Bang should tell the difference between inflation and any rival theory. Kip Thorne of Caltech believes that Lisa, or its successors, may determine whether some version of string theory is correct. As I explain in Chapter 7, the inflationary universe theory predicts that gravity waves emerging from the Big Bang should be quite violent, corresponding to the rapid exponential expansion of the early universe, while the ekpyrotic model predicts a much gentler expansion, accompanied by much smoother gravity waves. Lisa should be able to rule out various rival theories of the Big Bang and make a crucial test of string theory. Einstein lenses and rings. Yet another powerful tool in exploring the cosmos is the use of gravitational lenses and Einstein rings. As early as 1801, Berlin astronomer Johann Georg von Soldner was able to calculate the possible deflection of starlight by the sun's gravity. Although, because Soldner used strictly Newtonian arguments, he was off by a crucial factor of 2. Einstein wrote, "Half of this deflection is produced by the Newtonian field of attraction of the sun, the other half by the geometrical modification, curvature of space caused by the sun." In 1912, even before he completed the final version of general relativity, Einstein contemplated the possibility of using this deflection as a lens, in the same way that your glasses bend light before it reaches your eye. In 1936, a Czech engineer, Rudi Mandl, wrote to Einstein asking whether a gravity lens could magnify light from a nearby star. The answer was yes, but it would be beyond their technology to detect this. In particular, Einstein realized that you would see optical illusions, such as double images of the same object, or a ring-like distortion of light. Light from a very distant galaxy passing near our sun, for example, would travel both to the left and right of our sun before the beams rejoined and reached our eye. When we gaze at the distant galaxy, we see a ring-like pattern, an optical illusion caused by general relativity. Einstein concluded that there was not much hope of observing this phenomenon directly. In fact, he wrote that this work is of little value, but it makes the poor guy, Mandl, happy. Over 40 years later, in 1979, the first partial evidence of lensing was found by Dennis Walsh of the Jordell Bank Observatory in England, who discovered the double quasar Q0957+561. In 1988, the first Einstein ring was observed from the radio source MG1131+0456. In 1997, the Hubble Space Telescope and the UK's Merlin Radio Telescope Array caught the first completely circular Einstein ring by analyzing the distant galaxy 1938+666, vindicating Einstein's theory once again. The ring is tiny, only a second of arc, or roughly the size of a penny viewed from 2 miles away. The astronomers described the excitement they felt witnessing this historic event. "At first sight, it looked artificial, and we thought it was some sort of defect in the image. But then we realized we were looking at a perfect Einstein ring," said Ian Brown of the University of Manchester. "Today, Einstein's rings are an essential weapon in the arsenal of astrophysicists. About 64 double, triple, and multiple quasars, illusions caused by Einstein lensing, have been seen in outer space, or roughly one in every 500 observed quasars. Even invisible forms of matter, like dark matter, can be seen by analyzing the distortion of light waves they create. In this way, one can obtain maps showing the distribution of dark matter in the universe. Since Einstein lensing distorts galactic clusters by creating large arcs rather than rings, it is possible to estimate the concentration of dark matter in these clusters. In 1986, the first giant galactic arcs were discovered by astronomers at the National Optical Astronomy Observatory, Stanford University, and Midi-Pyrenees Observatory in France. Since then, about 100 galactic arcs have been discovered, the most dramatic in the galactic cluster Abel 2218. Einstein lenses can also be used as an independent method to measure the amount of machos in the universe, which consist of ordinary matter like dead stars, brown dwarfs, and dust clouds. In 1986, Bodin Paczynski of Princeton realized that if machos passed in front of a star, they would magnify its brightness and create a second image. In the early 1990s, several teams of scientists, such as the French Eros, the American-Australian Macho, and the Polish-American Ogle, applied this method to the center of the Milky Way galaxy and found more than 500 micro-lensing events. More than expected, because some of this matter consisted of low-mass stars and not true machos. This same method can be used to find extrasolar planets orbiting other stars. Since a planet would exert a tiny but noticeable gravitational effect on the mother star's light, Einstein lensing can, in principle, detect them. Already, this method has identified a handful of candidates for extrasolar planets, some of them near the center of the Milky Way. Even Hubble's constant and the cosmological constant can be measured using Einstein lenses. Hubble's constant is measured by making a subtle observation. Quasars brighten and dim with time. One might expect that double quasars, being images of the same object, would oscillate at the same rate. Actually, these twin quasars do not quite oscillate in unison. Using the known distribution of matter, astronomers can calculate the time delay divided by the total time it took light to reach Earth. By measuring the time delay in the brightening of the double quasars, one can then calculate its distance from Earth. Knowing its redshift, one can then calculate the Hubble constant. This method was applied to the quasar Q0957+561, which was found to be roughly 14 billion light-years from Earth. Since then, the Hubble constant has been computed by analyzing seven other quasars. Within error bars, these calculations agree with known results. What is interesting is that this method is totally independent of the brightness of stars, such as Cepheids and Type 1a supernovae, which gives an independent check on the results. The cosmological constant, which may hold the key to the future of our universe, can also be measured by this method. The calculation is a bit crude, but it is also in agreement with other methods. Since the total volume of the universe was smaller billions of years ago, the probability of finding quasars that will form an Einstein lens was also greater in the past. Thus, by measuring the number of double quasars at different times in the evolution for the universe, one can roughly calculate the total volume of the universe, and hence the cosmological constant, which is helping to drive the universe's expansion. In 1998, astronomers at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics made the first crude estimate of the cosmological constant and concluded that it probably made up no more than 62% of the total matter-energy content of the universe. The actual WMAP result is 73%. Dark matter in your living room. Dark matter, if it does pervade the universe, does not solely exist in the cold vacuum of space. In fact, it should also be found in your living room. Today, a number of research teams are racing to see who will be the first to snare the first particle of dark matter in the laboratory. The stakes are high. The team that is capable of capturing a particle of dark matter darting through their detectors will be first to detect a new form of matter in 2,000 years. The central idea behind these experiments is to have a large block of pure material, such as sodium iodide, aluminum oxide, freon, germanium, or silicon, in which particles of dark matter may interact. Occasionally, a particle of dark matter may collide with the nucleus of an atom and cause a characteristic decay pattern. By photographing the tracks of the particles involved in this decay, scientists can then confirm the presence of dark matter. Experimenters are cautiously optimistic, since the sensitivity of their equipment gives them the best opportunity yet to observe dark matter. Our solar system orbits around the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy at 220 kilometers per second. As a result, our planet is passing through a considerable amount of dark matter. Physicists estimate that 1 billion dark matter particles flow through every square meter of our world every second, including through our bodies. Although we live in a dark matter wind that blows through our solar system, experiments to detect dark matter in the laboratory have been exceedingly difficult to perform because dark matter particles interact so weakly with ordinary matter. For example, scientists would expect to find anywhere from 0.01 to 10 events per year occurring within a single kilogram of material in the lab. In other words, you would have to carefully watch large quantities of this material over a period of many years to see events consistent with dark matter collisions. So far, experiments with acronyms like UKDMC in the United Kingdom, Rosebud in Canfranc, Spain, Simple in Roustrel, France, and Edelweiss in Fréjus, France, have not yet detected any such events. An experiment called DAMA outside Rome created a stir in 1999 when scientists reportedly sighted dark matter particles. Because DAMA uses 100 kilograms of sodium iodide, it is the largest detector in the world. However, when the other detectors tried to reproduce DAMA's result, they found nothing, casting doubt on the DAMA findings. Physicist David B. Klein notes, "If the detectors do register and verify a signal, it would go down as one of the great accomplishments of the 21st century. The greatest mystery in modern astrophysics may soon be solved." If dark matter is found soon, as many physicists hope, it might give support to supersymmetry and, possibly, over time, to superstring theory, without the use of atom smashers. Suzy, supersymmetric, dark matter. A quick look at the particles predicted by supersymmetry shows that there are several likely candidates that can explain dark matter. One is the neutralino, a family of particles which contains the superpartner of the photon. Theoretically, the neutralino seems to fit the data. Not only is it neutral in charge and hence invisible, and also massive, so it is affected only by gravity, but it is also stable. This is because it has the lowest mass of any particle in its family, and hence cannot decay to any lower state. Last, and perhaps most important, the universe should be full of neutralinos, which would make them ideal candidates for dark matter. Neutralinos have one great advantage. They might solve the mystery of why dark matter makes up 23% of the matter-energy content of the universe, while hydrogen and helium make up only a paltry 4%. Recall that when the universe was 380,000 years old, the temperature dropped until atoms were no longer ripped apart by collisions caused by the intense heat of the Big Bang. At that time, the expanding fireball began to cool, condense, and form stable, whole atoms. The abundance of atoms today dates back roughly to that time period. The lesson is that the abundance of matter in the universe dates back to the time when the universe had cooled enough so that matter could be stable. This same argument can